For this episode, the Gateway is excited to welcome Colina Koltai, a senior investigator and trainer at the open source investigation outlet Bellingcat. She is an expert in socio-technical systems, especially in the intersection between misinformation and social media platforms. Colina has focused extensively on scientific and health misinformation and currently focuses on non-consensual AI deepfakes and AI-related misinformation. She received her PhD from the University of Texas at Austin in Information Studies and a postdoc at the University of Washington Center for an Informed Public. Colina, welcome to the Gateway. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you today.
So we are excited to go through all of the different things that you've done within your life, within your career, but I want to always start at the beginning. So can you give me a little bit of an explanation about what brought you to where you are today? Basically, how did you get here?
In a very linear fashion, where every step just made the exact same sense to get to where I am today. Like many people, I have had a journey of like ups and downs. It's sort of different topics that I've pursued throughout my life. And that oftentimes the thing that I come back to is I had an advisor back when I was young who told me that I suffered from a lack of focus, which I know sounds like kind of a mean thing to say, but I think what it was is that I'm often interested in a lot of things. I think he wanted me just to focus on the one project, the one research thing I was supposed to do. And I was like, no, I have all these other questions and I have these other things I'm interested in. And I think I've always been that kind of person who's interested in a lot of things. And so, if I go back all the way to the beginning of time, because say I was born in Los Angeles and I grew up in this awesome sort of city of like Hollywood and film and everything, but no. So let's just start the journey instead of my birth. I was in a master's program at California State University, Northridge at CSUN. And I was pursuing a degree in psychology there, but I was actually working in two different research labs. I was working in a psychology lab, which was an implicit bias and stereotype lab. And then I was also at the same time also working in a systems engineering lab, which is something completely different. But I was there working more like from a human factors perspective. So I was able to still use a bit of what I knew in psychology, but applying it to systems engineering. And so you can already get a sense that I'm kind of have a lot of interest. I'm a little bit all over the place in that sense. And then the advisor I had at that time in the engineering lab gave me this opportunity to be a research associate at NASA Ames in San Jose. And I couldn't say no. And so I had been at that point studying a little bit about with experimental test pilots with like on F-16. So we were looking at like recommender technologies and automated technologies that took control away from the pilot. So these were like collision avoidance technology I was working on. And then when I worked at NASA as an associate, I was looking at recommender systems that were automated for like large commercial aircraft. So imagine like a 747 or a 777. So these were like tools we were developing for pilots in sort of like emergency landing scenarios that they would give a recommendation of like, here's like a particular like approach and landing recommendation by the system. I also briefly worked a little bit too on like recommender tools and sort of like piloting tools for like multiple UAVs, which is an unmanned aerial vehicle. So how do we develop these sort of like tools and technologies for someone to be able to manage a high level of workload, making decisions, managing a lot of UAVs at the same time. So, I was taking this really sort of a lot of work focus on this relationship of like how we develop tools and also like tests the pilot's use on these tools for like in relationship to transparency and trust when we talk about these automated technologies. And I think this is kind of like the point where I really started getting and reading a lot more about automated technologies, not just like with aircraft, but and the way we think about automated technology, things that are and leading eventually into like AI nowadays. So I've been thinking about that for a long time, particularly in the way that we use these tools in our lives to make decisions about the world. So from this point, though, I decided after working on aircraft for a few years at this point that I still technically only had a bachelor's. And instead of going back to finish my master's degree, I decided to pursue a doctorate. bless my advisor. I applied and got into the University of Texas in Austin. So hook 'em horns. And my advisor there, Ken, wonderful, wonderful advisor. I highly recommend him. But I'd written this whole statement, got accepted, had this plan on studying automation transparency at Texas, based on all the work I've been doing about how we decide and trust automated technologies, recommender tools, digital systems, all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, which is 2015, a measles outbreak occurred in California, which is where I was living. And I became just obsessed with this idea of people who didn't want to vaccinate, because my whole life I had been taught that vaccines are good. You're supposed to vaccinate. You're required to vaccinate your kids to go to school. Why wouldn't you vaccinate? And I just didn't like the explanation of like, oh, these are just some crunchy granola moms, or these people are just idiots. Like, I'm like, that's not sufficient. You can't just say someone's an idiot and then they don't vaccinate and become this whole big thing. And so I remember even the email, I wrote to my advisor saying like, hey, I know you've accepted me and this is all good. And I said I was going to study automation, transparency, and trust in my statement of purpose. But I've changed my mind. I would like to study vaccine misinformation. I would like to study social media. I would like to study the way we information seeking behavior, the way we think about digital communities and these digital spaces in a way that we make decisions on scientific and health related topics, particularly when they're steeped in misinformation. And luckily for me, he said, okay. And he had told me later on when I graduated that he's like, you know, when I agreed to this and you came to me with the idea that you wanted to do this, I thought you would just, you know, do this maybe for a few months and you would burn out, because most, you know, PhD students, and a lot of people will say this, they'll come in with an idea, think about it, after like a little bit they'll switch to something else. Most people don't just stay with the same topic the entire time as they're working on your degree. And then but you know, look at me, 5 years later, I was still focused on vaccine misinformation, and it became a bigger and bigger topic. And then I think this really culminated, you know, because I was like, all right, I've done this for 5 years. I've learned, I've done a lot. And at some point I wanted to switch to something else. So even when I was applying, I was on the job market. So I was out doing job talks. I had even written to, about like, oh, I wanted to study like maybe incel communities or the manosphere or, you know, far right movements. I was kind of like, I want to go do something else. I even was looking at it potentially even like information avoidance behavior instead. But in 2020, a really interesting thing happened. And suddenly the topic of vaccine misinformation on social media and digital communities became a very important topic to other people besides me. And I kind of continued the work on that. So I went and ended up pursuing a postdoc at the University of Washington, continuing my work on vaccine misinformation and social media and all that kind of fun stuff. Now beyond childhood vaccines, which is where I rooted a lot of the work in, because that's where most of the literature was. But now focus obviously on COVID, and not just like vaccines, but obviously the way that we make decisions about what health behaviors we need to do, like wearing a mask. So I did that for a couple of years, but I would say that after 7 years of doing that, particularly two really intense years of focus on this kind of work, you get a little burnt out, or at least I got a little burnt out. And so I decided to change things up a little bit, and I ended up leaving my postdoc and pursuing a position at Twitter. And this is back when it was actually called Twitter, even though now it's called X. But I will call it Twitter probably for my ease, because I did work at Twitter. I did not work at X. and so I was working as part of the team there. Well, it's now called Community Notes, but at the time it was called Birdwatch, which is a sort of crowdsource approach to combating misinformation on social media, particularly on Twitter. So this is a, if you become part of the sort of Birdwatch or the Community Notes contributor team that like any person can become a part of, you can write and vote on bits of information that can get appended to the tweets. And so this is a really sort of like interesting way and a really sort of like novel approach to the way that a social media platform would be combating this information. And I thought this was useful because even during my time at UW, at the University of Washington, I was doing other projects related to misinformation, not just vaccines. We're talking about election related misinformation, not just other health and science stuff like pregnancy related misinformation. There, misinformation was like that's the topic. There's a lot of parallels in the work that you can do and researching vaccines into the other aspects of our lives. And so when I got this opportunity to go to the Birdwatch or the Community Notes team, I saw this as a great chance to take the skills and the knowledge that I knew and apply it to the social media space, because this is where we often see sort of like the space in which misinformation spreads. Like, why wouldn't I want an opportunity to help combat that issue? Unfortunately, while I was there for only a short period of time, while I was there, there was a somewhat public acquisition of the company, purchase of the company, and me, as along with thousands of other people, were let go by the current owner. So I had to then pivot to something else, something new. So I really enjoyed my time there, but then as I was sort of like wallowing in my unemployment, I saw this opportunity at Bellingcat to become an investigator and trainer here. And I thought, what another nice, fun opportunity for me to take the skills I've actually learned and refined over the well over a decade of doing research and a decade of particularly in misinformation to a space where I can maybe do some other public good. So now at Bellingcat, I work as an investigator. Particularly, I focus a lot on mis and disinformation. And this could be from anything in relation to election and politics. It can be to health. It definitely stuff that's happening in the current conflict between Israel and Hamas in the Middle East. And then a lot of work now also focused on AI technology. So AI related misinformation, but also AI image generation services, particularly in terms of generating non-consensual deepfake pornography of overwhelmingly women. And so it's been a bit of a journey. That's a very long answer to what I've been doing since probably my grad school days. But I feel like it's been this like interesting sort of development and change over time, and then with this interest in sort of studying and studying information. You know, it is it's I think I'm always intrigued with trying to make the world a better place in some capacity. And so whenever I do see the opportunity to do that, it's been something that's intriguing to me. I will always have an interest in something that has like some sort of real world impact, whether it was about making planes safer for pilots and for obviously passengers, to try to make the internet a safer place for everyone that uses it.
So I know you say that you are bouncing around in like you lack of focus. You're talking about lack of focus that your advisor said, but what do you think is the core, like the latent interest or late that runs across all these topics that you get interested in that attracts you to those topics?
You know, I think at the end of the day, the thing that interests me the most, if I put on my like psychology student hat, is I am a naturally very indecisive person. I will hem and haw back and forth on things. Like even say trying to book a hotel room for like if I need to travel for like a conference or a work thing, I spend way too much time looking at the location of all the hotels, what are the amenities, what are the prices, what are the deals, like an overwhelming amount of time making decision. And so I think, and so for my own selfishly motivated reasons of how do I become a better decision maker, I've really invested, I think I have this like underlying interest in the way that we make decisions about other things around the world. So whether it's been how do pilots make a decision of like where to land an emergency scenario, to how to like parents make a decision whether or not to vaccinate their kids, or a decision of what to trust, not what to trust online, or how to vote, things like that. Of you know, there is I think we there's unless you're an absolute Luddite, we cannot divorce ourselves from the fact that technology, as not just a tool, but as like an information source, is proliferated in every sort of component of our lives, whether that's from a professional sense or our individual sense. And so I think a lot of the work that I do and I focus on is really steeped in really not just understanding people, but But technology itself, because that at the end of the day, technology is created by humans, it's shaped by humans. It is something, my background, my doctorate's in information studies, and the dean of our school likes to say, like, what is information studies? People don't really know what it is. What's information science? And it's about the intersection between people, data, and technology. And that sounds very broad and sounds very vague, but in reality, that is the best way I can approach the thing, trying to understand the way we interact with the world and make a decision when we're in this high sort of like workload scenario about, from anything of how to decide what to eat or what hotel room, what restaurant to go to really critical decisions of whether or not you're going to choose to vaccinate your child or choose like a job or who to vote for and sort of these like things that come with more and more great, oh, sorry, greater and greater risk.
That makes total sense. I think most of, like, the work that people are doing in the world every day, it is at the intersection of people and technology. So I think that's extremely important, as you said.
Colina, as you're looking at these different topics and misinformation and how we make decisions, I keep going back to my days in grad school when I was kind of that psychology student. And I remember something very specifically coming through some research being wrong feels right until you're presented with that information and you accept that you are wrong. So, like, you can walk around all day long thinking, oh, I know this bit of information, but if you're never confronted with the correct information, you feel like you're right. When we have tools that now present physical people in different situations that might be fake, when we have AI technology that creates images that are fake but look real, when our reality starts to blur, how do we then know when we're actually going to be wrong? Or I'm trying to get to something at a more human level here of being like, what do we know what's real and what's that going to look like from your perspective?
I think it's harder and harder to figure out actually what is real. Like if I don't know if you guys have ever done this yourself, if you have seen a tweet or a video or even a news article and you're trying to figure out how you should maybe feel about it or just interested in what other people are thinking. And so a lot of times we say go to the comments, which is you want to see what other humans are talking about this, that you kind of want to have this like human connection. And that's the reason why comments are always an interesting place to go to on any sort of digital space. And we're at this point too where like even like algorithmically, particularly we look at depending on the platform, this will vary, of course, but people don't always even get the exact same comments. And so the way that we like moderate the way that we should be feeling at the world is oftentimes even determined or even guided, I should say, by algorithmic sort of decisions that are outside of our control. So we might think we're I think to get to this point of how do we know we're right? How do we know it's reality? We can talk from a very philosophical way and say like we never know, we are not ever based in any reality, or that the way that we experience the world is a reality, but that doesn't necessarily have to jive with everyone else's reality. We have our own realities, and that's getting really into some sort of like big epistemological sort of like understandings of the world. But the way that I like to think about it is I like to use other humans, real humans, to base sort of my understanding. Like, even if it's something from as simple as the experience of like, hey, did you hear that noise? Did you see that thing? Or isn't that crazy? Like you've done that. Like to be like, am I understanding the world in a very sort of like real way right now? To like, should I be upset about this? Or is this thing a true thing that I'm seeing? And we've got from a point where we normally use people within our physical space to our digital spaces to help us understand that, because we are not in a silo, we're not in a complete vacuum, even if we're considered online. And so I think that's why we've had seen a lot of like misinformation communities grow and thrive, because you are being able to find those spaces where you are sort of getting that feedback of like, yes, I'm right. This is something that's crazy. This is something that sort of makes sense, or this doesn't make sense, or these are things that we should be outraged about, and it's not. And so I think it's hard because this is beyond just trying to think of like just bubbles. This is not about like say a bubble. It's about sort of like a communal sort of feedback you are getting. to how you should help understand the world. And I think, it's something that kind of roots us in a particular reality about information. Now, we can go into nitty-gritties about examples. Like, if you see a piece of news article, there's always all sorts of advice about, check all the sourcing. We can talk ourselves to death about that. Like, see how the topic is being covered. Wait until there's greater coverage, like in a breaking news scenario, right? We don't always know everything and we want to know everything. Mm-hmm. Like, we have this human innate desire to want to know what's going on. Like, say an extreme case that's all too real in the US is like, you hear about a school shooting and you're like, I want to know what's going on at the school shooting. And there's very little information, as there often is in the beginning. And so you'll see sort of this, like, you call it like a data void, where anything can come and like fill that space, that data void, because we want to know. And so we see misinformation have opportunities to really thrive and spread in that sort of space and cause greater chaos. And so when we see that happening, this misinformation spreading, people are sort of trying to understand what is that reality. We've can follow onto that. And so it's only then later on when we're trying to then later, we've now gotten a better sense, like the breaking news situations passed, and we're now trying to unpack what is the thing that really happened and what didn't. And now it becomes really hard to divorce from your understanding of like that experience of like, wait, what was true, what wasn't true? And then you start thinking like, is this being covered up? Is my reality changing? And then it becomes hard to like, to sort of disentangle yourself from viral misinformation that happens in this sort of like breaking news space, because it filled that space. Even when there's all this work that's been done, that even when people are immediately presented with a correction of some sort of misinformation, if it sort of like starts to clash with their worldview or their reality, it's harder bits of corrections to adjust for. Like, it's almost like the damage of that misinformation has been done. So this is a very long, windy answer, very long academic answer of like how we know what to be true and not to be true. And I think it's difficult. I don't bemoan anyone or blame anyone if they fall for misinformation. I fall for misinformation consistently, like it's in the sense that I would say consistently, but like it's anyone, it can be susceptible to misinformation. Anyone can be susceptible to hearing a rumor. Sometimes it can be more devastating in some cases than others. And it's something that probably I think a very normal human experience nowadays. But it's hard because there are some people who are still able to get, say, rooted in sort of what we say think of as a collective reality, versus people who are very, very far off, sort of like a outlier on their understanding of what is their reality. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, Kalina, it was absolutely perfect, because that's where I think sometimes those pieces of misinformation are more, I don't want to, more fun. They're more enjoyable. They're titillating. They're something that adds to it. And just like a child, when you expound on a story, all of a sudden it sounds way more interesting, even though it may not be the truth. And so we enjoy that. We kind of divulge and dive into those elements of that human side of it. But then we sometimes forget that it can be very damaging with that when it comes to the information of health choices and what you should do as a collective community. And for the work you're doing with Bellingcat right now, how do you start to decipher truth when you're doing a journalism, when you're trying to reveal true facts and create that from nothing when there's a bunch of information coming your way? How do you go about that in your current role?
That's a great question, and it's something we often discuss at Bellingcat, because I feel like and this can be true for I think any journalist, is that you're now in this position, this role that has a responsibility of trying to be as accurate and as truthful as possible. I think it's a different position than say like an academic has, even though they have similar, there's definitely parallels there, because obviously when you're publishing a piece of research, you obviously want to represent that in a particular way, but journalism has a much shorter time frame, let's just say, in the work that comes out than in academic publishing. And so it's hard. So if we take like examples like, If we want to talk about the conflict that's happening right now in Gaza, because this has been, I've been studying misinformation for a number of years now, and while I've not always focused on conflict, this has been a particularly notable conflict in relationship to like just the quantity and the virality of misinformation, the use of AI images, and even more so because of when we think about like AI related image misinformation, we often think like, oh, there's a viral piece of, faked imagery that people are believing. But I think one of the other more damaging components is that there are real images that are coming out that people are accusing of being AI. And now that's even like clashing and trying to like ruin what, not ruin, but like it is more for sort of like our understanding of what is reality. And not only that, there are plenty of very real verifiable graphic images that come out of this conflict. And so you're almost like lessening the voice of the real images that are out there by the use and spread of fake AI generated imagery. And so I personally have not been a big fan of the use of AI imagery in this case, but people like to create it and use it. And it's dangerous because once an image is created in this sort of environment, or like when anyone creates it. So like you could find, say, an Instagram account that's dedicated to creating AI images, and they clearly say it's AI related. People take that image and then spread it on another platform, and you decontextualize it from like its original source. And then all the da additional damage is done from that. And so, some of the process that we do is if we're trying to do a story that's related to misinformation, we do our best to sort of trace the steps. Like one of the things, like if you're doing talk about like image verification, and that's there's many many sort of components in terms of like how we verify content or a story or anything. But say we're just taking AI im or images as an example, we see if we could find it somewhere on the internet online first, and that's oftentimes like, is this an original image? Is our first step, right? You can use a lot of like reverse image search tools, some selective keyword searching, things like that. To see if this is an older piece of image. And we found that to be the case for sometimes a lot of images that are being reused from the Syrian war. And so you see that content being reused, and you're like, okay, we're able to say that this does not accurately represent the situation. We know this is older content. But now we get to say, sorry, if that isn't the case, we can't find it online somewhere else before. This might be the first time. Now we have to think about like, we need to geolocate the context. Is this something that's happening actually in Gaza, or is it not? And so now I just say like, not only when does the content appear? Is it original content? Where is this content actually located? You can take a look and see who is the person originally posting the content, because sometimes the place where you maybe first see it is not the original poster. And so you have to go to alternative platforms. So oftentimes, like particularly for the Middle East, we've been looking a lot on like Telegram groups to see as like maybe this is like the first spot, or at least maybe where it started getting a lot of traction and then moving to other mainstream social media platforms. And trying to take little bits, like we sometimes honestly in like a say a video, take it frame by frame to see what can we identify from this video clip that will either give us a clue about who are the people, what's happening. Is the context in which it's being shared matches up with what's actually happening? We listen to the audio of it. We look for unique identifying features to identify location. There's a ton of work that's put into sort of verification when we're trying to put together a story. And if we can't meet those standards, we don't share it, we don't publish it, because there's that level of expectation, I think, in journalism that you can't just say like, oh, here's this content that went viral, but then that's it. You need to do the extra level of like, it's like the, because we at Bellingcat, we focus on using open source investigative techniques. We rely on open source or sort of like say from satellite images to user generated content to what we can find essentially on search platforms to be able to sort of come to some sort of level of confidence that what we when we say like this is what's happening in the video, this is, and then we walk out those steps like you would in like an academic paper. You say like, here's our methods, here's how we know what we do. We do the same thing in a different level that you might say in like other journalists outlets, is that we say like, here's how you found the image, this is what we do, this is how we know what's happening, and this is how you too can do the exact same step. So it's almost like I don't want to say it's an instructional manual, but the goal of a lot of the work that we have and the way we publish and something that's kept in mind is that the investigative work that we do, in theory, could be done by anyone. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but the point is that we're not hiding, getting anything from some secret unknown source. We're not saying, hey, just trust me on this. This is what we're saying. We walk through and provide like a high level of transparency of how we come to our conclusion. So, and that the reader should be able to then follow along and say, this makes sense. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about the work we do at Bellingcat is that level of trust and transparency is so critical to the work we do, to the way we write, to the way we approach content, that it is, I think, a special standard that we hold to ourselves when we think about publishing.
Colina, I have to admit, like, it doesn't happen all the time that I'm kind of just listen and be quiet in a podcast. This is one of those episodes where, like, I really want to hear from you as much as possible. But I do remember that basically your career is going over some very important events and topic. Like, you talk about misinformation and vaccination, and then pandemic happened. You talk about working as a researcher and misinformation at a big social media like the former Twitter, now X, and now focusing on misinformation and social media and in AI. I think you are really on super important topics and super relevant topics. And I'm like you. Whenever I have to look for something, I search for hours and hours and hours. Like, it can be an hotel, it can be a restaurant, it can be like articles. I want to make sure that the information I'm reading is actually a fact. As you were saying, you were talking about trust and transparency. Unfortunately, though, I believe that while there are people like you or even people like me that they try to always corroborate the different information that they receive, they investigate, they make sure that is actually something they can act upon. I think nowadays the world goes at a different speed, right? So while you're doing this work to make sure that that's actually trustable and transparent, there are people that are keep resharing, right, and talking about, and this to me is like the scary part of technology and social media at this point, right? I don't know if I have a question. I don't know if I just want to hear it from you. What are your thoughts on this? But I stopped using social media. I stopped looking at people's comments just because of how scary it is, to see clear wrong stuff or like fake stuff being shared, lighthearted, seeing several type of comments that are like very not human, in my opinion. And it's just like tough to see how I don't know, and I hope like social media company are thinking about ways of labeling or saying like, hey, this is probably a fake. Think about it before resharing, before making up your mind over stuff, right? Because it's very dangerous, I think, and it can be problematic in the long run, as people shape their ideas. They just look for something that they believe in, and even though it's completely untrue. And yeah, and I think I'm kind of stuck at this, and I think about it a lot, and I just don't have a solution. But I just want your opinion on this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there. I think you're touching on a real issue that I think we're a conflict with. There's a few things there. Like one is not everyone has the time, the skill set, the mental capacity, not mental capacity, but like is there more like workloads, the time to dedicate to looking at and investigating every article, every piece of information. This is why trust is so important. Like, not everyone needed to go and get a degree in immunology during the pandemic. We needed to have trust in our experts, and a lot of that was degraded and eroded for a whole long list of reasons. That's a whole other podcast episode of our trust in science and research and our institutions. But I think that that's part of the difficulty is that we as we navigate our lives are supposed to have trust in a lot of these sort of foundations that and institutions that we use, because it's a lot of work. It's like, you know, when I go say to a physician because I need to figure out say something, so like I need their advice, like I shouldn't have to be the one that goes and like starts doing a ton of like research and try to like read, you know, medical journal articles, do all this additional research. We all tend to sometimes, I think, do, but you know, it is, we should have like, you know, trust in a doctor. We should have trust in a professor. And this is not saying like, oh, they should just blindly and not question. You should obviously be able to like have question, have this conversation if you're interested and want to learn and get that deeper explanation. But I think, you know, it's unreasonable. Like I know I spend way too much time trying to make a decision. It's my decision paralysis that I have. And you can think about that in relation to the way that people have really invested in misinformation communities, or I think about the way that we invest in our how we navigate our day-to-day world. You know, like there's plenty of people out there when they go in to say vote for election, for their local election, for big, you know, statewide, you know, national, federal level elections, where they don't have the time to pass it to say go and research every single bill, every single candidate. They don't. And so sometimes they make other intuitive guesses because it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time to look and research everything. And I think that's it's an unfair expectation to that. And the other bit about this is about social media. I feel like if I could, I would probably uninstall every single social media platform. I probably would never go on it again. But you know, for a lot of the work that I do, obviously it's not really the case. Although I will say I mostly use research accounts. I don't have like I don't use very much my personal account, so it's at least a little bit more separated. But I think there is this real need, this real worry. I think that this happened to a lot of people I know that. It's rather upsetting to see people fall for misinformation. It gets very frustrating. I think, you know, we can, everyone's got like an anecdote they can tell about in sometime the past like 6 years of a conversation they've had with someone who they felt like was, they were just wrong, and like how frustrating it is to have a conversation who's just with someone who's wrong, that you feel like it's wrong. And for them, they probably felt the exact same way. And it's disheartening, you know. I think, you know, I see viral misinformation happen all the time, and people just absolutely believe me, and knowing there's very little I could do at that moment to say, like, I need to stop this. Now, I think the other issue is like this idea about personal responsibility, or not personal, sorry, like responsibility on the side of the platforms. Now, I think the hardest part with this is that there are certainly work that's being done at places like Meta and other platforms on how to handle misinformation. But at the end of the day, these are companies, and companies are going to care ultimately about the bottom line, their financial dollar. And so the work to remove or moderate and handle misinformation, particularly in the speed that it spreads, is astronomical. I think platforms were not really ready for it, and they have it's been like, gosh, there's a phrase, after I'll tell you if I can remember the phrase, where it's like you can build like the most like idiot-proof device, and then, you know, a human will just become like a better idiot. Something along that. It's like there's a phrase like that. Is that like, you know, in the way that we think about it's a similar analogy to the way that you think about like AI detection tools or any other technology that we develop to like combat misinformation in some capacity. Is that there are peoples and organizations and all sorts of different entities out there that are actively working to make misinformation more viral, more profitable, more useful to them in some way. There's a reason why misinformation continues to spread, continues to viral. People can still create it. You know, it's something that I don't think we'll ever be able to put a cap on. I don't think any platform's going to figure it out, because also it's in some ways it's doesn't behoove them in some way. This all takes a lot of money. I think you'd end up taking financial losses if you really truly invested the amount of time and resources it needs to tackle the issue. I think you're not only fighting like it's an arms race, but I just don't think they're going to spend the money on it. And that's not to say they haven't spent money. It's just it's something that at the end of the day they are out to make money on these platforms. And so if the
No.
goal, yeah, that's it. They're out to make money. The goal isn't to keep people safe always on the platform. It's about making sure people don't get misinformation. It's about keeping people on there engaged in the content, looking at ads and making money. And if that is the bottom line, it's tackling misinformation does not always run parallel to that goal.
And I think this is the most scary part for me, because the amount of data that they have about the user, right? They know exactly what you're looking for, and they keep feeding you that. And like your level of trust is 100% because they are keep feeding you the stuff that you want to read. And so the control that they have in what they show you is the scary part. You never look at the other side of the story. I think one of the big problem is a lot of topic that shouldn't be, for example, political, like vaccine, right? They are made political, or like guns in school and shootings and stuff like that. They are made politicals, at least in the US, but in many other Western countries as well. So it's that the part that to me is very frustrating. And I agree with you, like they probably, the majority of them don't care. They care about, the money. In the end, but I think people need to wake up and really understand that, hey, you keep seeing the stuff that they think you like, and you need to find alternative way. And that's why, like, Bellingcat came to my mind. We were literally talking about that the other episode, where to find information. And I'm very appreciative of the work that you guys do. And I hope more of our listeners will start looking at you guys when it comes to, hey, let me make sure, or let me see what they are find out with their investigation, just because it's a frustrating point for me. It's very tough to put into words. I know my question was very not very good articulated, but I really have a tough time with this, and I hope people start to get more aware of it shouldn't be, some of the stuff shouldn't be political, and some of those stuff, you always need to look on the other side, or look for information that really you can trust. Not because your best friend that thinks exactly like you share that post, you need to automatically share it. Or because somebody that you follow shares something, you need to automatically share it. It spreads so fast, I think even faster than people think. And that's what I think is the problem.
I 100% agree. And along that topic, I want to, I remember an observation I had before 2020 election. Twitter said that they're not going to take political ads, if I remember right. But mm-hmm. Facebook didn't do that. So I think that's the time. No, you went there after 2020. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was there in, I think, 2022, I think.
Okay. I agree with both of you. Of course, I'm not an expert. It's a personal opinion that these platforms are not on our side. I don't think they are. They just want to make as much money as possible. And misinformation makes more money than actual information, it just seems like. Because as Russ said, it's more entertaining and more attractive. But that when Twitter did that, I felt that that was a right direction, because that was the actual, that was the first real step towards some effective policy that I had seen. Because basically what Twitter was saying at that time is, we are a place where people come to say whatever they want. And when something becomes too important to talk about, we don't want to let them say whatever they want. That's exactly what they did. And as you said, I don't think we're ever going to be done with misinformation. I feel like we just have to try and control misinformation that is harmful. And we are on our own. These platforms are not on our side unless we, force them through policy. And the only way to force them is through policy. And then it is political. Everything is political.
Everything's political.
Yeah.
I mean,
forces through policy.
Yeah. I mean, you bring up a couple of like great points, which is like, like even when I talk about vaccines, and there's a lot of like science in itself inherently will always be political. But up until recently, vaccines were considered rather like nonpartisan. Like if you look at like Pew Research Center's previous polling on vaccine related hesitancy, it was actually, you would see sort of equitable numbers on say like both right and left leaning, and it wasn't always, say, a vaccine hesitancy where it was aligned, say, with like right leaning or the GOP. Like even in Texas, Governor Rick Perry at the time was trying to mandate the HPV vaccine. So it's something that it's only become politicized in the more recent years, as just to use the vaccine example, because it's been so drastically politicized, obviously in the past 4 years. And believe it or not, when I spoke to my advisor about wanting to switch to do the vaccines, because I had brought up this other idea about wanting to study climate change and people's responses to that. And he's like, no, climate change is too political. We'll go vaccines, far less political. Which is like, you know, it's funny to think that in hindsight. gosh, there was another point that I was going to make about what were you used to saying? There was that point. I was going to make one more point about
Twitter didn't allow ads.
Yes, Twitter. So the other thing is that, and only because it's an example I do like bringing up, is that Pinterest, this is back in 2016 that they did this, but at the time, right around, because 2015 is when that big measles outbreak occurred, and so we started seeing these spikes, these mini outbreaks happening across not just the U.S., but we saw this happening in the U.K., Canada, Australia. A lot of places started having sort of these like little pockets of growing movements of people who are vaccine hesitant, spreading vaccine misinformation, and Pinterest was and still is a very popular platform in which to like collect these boards and collect it. And so there was a growing anti-vaccination sort of movement also happening on a platform like Pinterest, but they decided and made a policy change in 2016 just saying, no, we're just not going to allow that information on the platform. The only vaccine related content we're going to allow on Pinterest is stuff from sort of large government institutions. So stuff like say CDC, I forget the exact wording on the policy, but they made a decision years before it became sort of the to the national level in which the conversation was. And I think that was such a smart decision on their end. And I forget the name of the woman who pirated. I've talked to her a few times, but the woman at the time who like really, really pushed, she like was an advocate and really pushed for this policy and had gotten pushed back. And so it took someone from like the inside really pushing to make sure this policy gets enacted, because the company didn't want to say like we're restricting some sort of bit of information. They didn't think that was going to be financially beneficial for the for the platform. But in the long run, that did pay off because, you know, it didn't become, it could have been a massive, massive hotbed for vaccine misinformation, and it got too big. At that point, then if you're restricting it is, and saying you can't allow this content, it could have caused like a huge blowback. Like if say they made that decision in like 2020 or 2021, that would have made it a big blowback, but they made a decision in 2016, back when the issue was small, you had an expert who was advocating for this change, and it was the right choice. And so I think that becomes, it's a good example in the way that we need to be aware of and almost like hyper-focus on the types of movements and sort of the ways that people are using platforms in these digital spaces, because you kind of want to sometimes nip initially like this in the button and make a decision like we're going to only use or allow this type of information. So making the decision to say, we're not going to accept money from, for like political ads, or we're not going to accept vaccine related information unless it's from like a large institutional like health organization. Like those are policy decisions made for like the betterment of it. And so I think there are ways that platforms can certainly address it, but I know it's sometimes controversial to say like maybe that content just shouldn't be on a mainstream platform. Like there are certainly smaller alt platform spaces you can think about, like Telegram as an example, or Gab or Rumble or any sort of like alt tech related platforms, but still so many so far fewer people use those spaces to find that kind of content. We're talking about like sort of on a mainstream large level of like the kind of spaces we're in. Like most people, there's still millions and millions of people who are on Facebook, who are on X or Twitter, who are on Instagram, you know, these are on YouTube, some of the like big sort of social media spaces. And so I think there's a lot of pressure on those. And sometimes those spaces maybe do need to be the most restrictive because we have the most people in those spaces. And so I think there needs to be a sort of reorganization in the way we think about what is policy, how do we make something that's profitable? Not that I don't care, but like ultimately it's not my job to make sure platforms make money, but certainly there are other ways to make money. Pinterest is still around, even though they made that decision to ban anti-vaccination content. And so I think there are ways that that companies can do this. It's just you almost need someone advocating for that change, even though you might think it makes a short-term financial loss, but really long-term, it's for the betterment.
I know we are running out of time, but I think like I say some of those things like social media should kind of label misinformation, but as you said, it's very hard and it takes a lot of time, and the way the content is generated is make it even more challenging. On top of that, if you make some of those decisions, there's gonna be very unpopular towards some groups, right? And then they will start some those boycott this, boycott that campaigns. They go super viral, and I do remember like when Trump Twitter account was suspended, there was like huge boycotting Twitter campaign going on. That new social media was born for that, right? So it's challenging for a company that at the end of the day cares about making profit to make those decisions, although are the right one ethically, like speaking, there is no debate, right? So I in the end is in the users, I think. Although again, I'm very worried about this because not many users care about what you were talking about, like what you guys at Bellingcat do, trustworthy and transparent investigations, right? And I don't know if there is a solution, but I just hope that our listeners like keep those things in mind before taking any action based on what they read on social media, either video or images, because nowadays they can both be created and look very, very real, but they are not.
Yeah, it's a tough situation out there. There's an analogy that's sometimes used, which is like the seatbelt analogy, right? Like if it was up to users or people who would drive cars, there's still plenty of people who don't wear a seatbelt. But we did put in a law that says you're required to wear a seatbelt. A lot of people don't like that. Every time my dad gets in the car, I was like, "Dad, you have to wear a seatbelt," even though he does not want to do so. Sometimes there's I think a hard balance. This is why it's a difficult conversation. That's why there's no good solution. There's no sort of like magic pill, magic sort of here's the $1 million problem answer. To say like here's how you solve everything because it's complex. You got to balance a person's individual rights and freedom with like policies at large companies with like legislation on like a large national level about and regulation. Think about the way information changes and adapts over time. We think about like adversarial agents who are actively working and like proliferating misinformation. We think about people who unintentionally spread it. There is, and think about sort of the balance also with humor, right? If we think about sort of the fun components of it, it's like an outlet, say like The Onion is parody related, but everything they put out is technically is misinformation. And there are people who still fall for it. There's even a whole subreddit dedicated to like, it's like R ate The Onion for people who fall for what otherwise for most people would say is clearly identified misinformation, but for a humorous reason there is it's I don't have the solution to combating misinformation. I think the sometimes even the one that may actually work the most is not something that's actually feasible in any way, which like you might say like we get rid of social media altogether. That's nothing that's gonna happen. Or social media platforms make a lot of decisions that are not profitable to them, but it's better for like the public health or the public good. I just don't think that's gonna happen if I'm being realistic. And when we think about AI technology, partly if we're going to like tie it all back to AI, and AI is a very sort of broad term because we could think of, anything from like large language models or LLMs. We think about like image generation or image editing with AI technology. We think about like audio deepfakes, video deepfakes. There is a and sort of like a mix even across the board of the way we think about what is like artificial intelligence. Or really fancy like statistical regressions essentially. We think about the potential and the speed. Like when we if we think about misinformation as an issue, the speed and ease in which misinformation is created and then able to spread is exorbitantly high. And it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort from, say, fact checkers or journalists to be able to do the work to say this is not true and here's all the reasons why it's not true. And ultimately, when that content is shared, it doesn't go nearly as wide or as viral as the misinformation itself, because it's not exciting. It's much more exciting to read a fun, outrageous story or something that's like horrific that happens than like, oh, what the reality is sometimes. And so we're at this sort of like unbalanced relationship between what content goes and spreads online and what we see. But not only that, the time component of it is that we just cannot keep up with the speed. So we're thinking of AI technology as a way that's could potentially accelerate not only the creation, but also this, the creation speed of the content, but the quantity of the content, and even algorithmically, that content even going viral, going even more widespread. We're at this sort of point where you have to think about like, how do we do the work that we do at a similar speed? And we cannot compete. I cannot compete with people who can create, you know, 100 different AI related images, you know, in the span of a day or less than a day even, and versus working and pointing out why this image is not real or this image is not real. It's turtles all the way down. It is a arms race that it's hard. And so we need to really think about what are our real solutions out there to address the issue, this marriage between AI technology and misinformation, because it's going to change exponentially over the next few years. We already know misinformation is an issue, and AI is a way to make that misinformation easier, quicker, faster. The example I just use, and we do these trainings where, you know, we can have journalists and people from NGOs and whoever, actually anyone can sign up to attend our training workshops. And this is around the same time that the Met Gala was happening. And there was several viral AI generated images of celebrities attending the Met Gala that were not true. And ultimately, that doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, it's a fake image of Katy Perry or Rihanna or Lady Gaga at the Met Gala when they weren't even attending this year. Mm-hmm. But I think it spoke to the sort of underlying thing of like the ease in which those images were created, the virality of those images being spread, the believability of those images. If that can happen mm-hmm. on something that's so low stakes as a celebrity attending a Met Gala, you think about the damage that can happen on things that are like in terms of like conflict, so war, human conflict, right, suffering, and then shifting what we know to be true. So we're thinking this bringing back to reality, right? This idea that we have images and videos that are real, that are happening, of atrocities that have happened, thousands of miles away from where I'm located. And people just do not believe it because they think this must be AI generated. And that is part of the danger of it, is that we are losing potentially the biggest thing on the table we have to lose is our ability to sense what is real and what's not. Not because we can't know that this AI image is fake, but because we start doubting the things that are real. Yeah. And that's where this danger comes from.
I know we are running out of time, but I would like to express a radical opinion about this.
Yeah.
I think the only way out is through. This is what I've been thinking about. With AI, as you say, it's going to be the generation of misinformation is going to accelerate. And maybe at some point people will come to realization that not necessarily everything that I read online is true. So then let's just see, go back to 1900s and see what can we trust. Okay, mainstream media that is accountable to each other and they're independent. Let's trust that. Other than that, I know there are issues with mainstream independent media, but what is better? Social media? Fringe media? What is it? I think if this happens enough, unfortunately, we don't know if that will result in irreparable damages in society and global order. But if that happens enough, people will have to come back to the conclusion that we have to just trust independent media other than someone talking online. For example, and there's something about the power of the written word. Like if I go on the street and someone walks up to me and says, let me give you public health information. I was like, who are you? Don't talk to me. But people online sit down and write public health information about vaccines and public health misinformation, and some people buy it. They wouldn't have necessarily, I would have a hard time believing they would have bought it if someone walked up to them in the street and told them that. The same about climate change, especially if something that is, as you said, believable. For example, the Met Gala example is, I think that people who did that are genius because people wear anything, outrageous things there. And it's not that hard to create believable things, especially when people don't want to believe the things that are unpleasant. For example, people don't want to believe climate change is real. That's why they don't, because it's just, we don't like it. I don't like it either. And they didn't want to believe that COVID was dangerous because it was unpleasant. And then, as you said, that void is filled. But eventually, if this is done long enough, it just plays out enough times that maybe after generations, new generations will just see through it. I don't know. I think that's the only way out is through. That's what I think.
That's definitely like a radical idea. I mean, the thing is, we don't know yet, right? I think
Exactly.
it's just, I think it's anyone that says, "Oh, I know exactly what's going to happen in the next 5 years," is selling you something. Because
I'm
I
not
think
trying to,
there's a
but
lot of potential, right? Like
maybe
I
I
like
should.
well, no, because there's like this question, because I do think, for example, that a lot of AI technology is overhyped. Like I do think there are things that there people are blowing out of proportion, and so it's hard to modulate. Like, what do we trust? What is reality? What are our true capabilities? And sort of the costs that are associated with them. And I think there is this interesting point of where we can potentially reach a point of like almost like information overload, right? Where it's hard to like disentangle, what we know to be true, like what is trustworthy. And that is the big question. What happens then? Who do we decide to trust? Do we just trust no one? Do we just sort of opt out of everything? And I think it's a lot, because like I have decision paralysis where you just don't know what to do. So maybe you opt out, you decide not to vote. But I think it's we don't know. Like AI can be really overhyped. We could get at a point where we just have a hard time disentangling what is real, what's not. I think the risk is when we think about, when we get to the level of like, say, war crimes, and we have people who are like, I don't know if this is real or not real, and then there's no accountability. And I think that's something we haven't even talked about yet, is this idea of who is accountable. And when we have atrocities that are happening across the rest of the world, if we can't disentangle what is real, what's not, no one becomes accountable for horrific things that have happened. And that's like sort of the big risk. It's like, it's one thing if it's about Met Gala, it's another thing if we're talking about war crimes.
That's what I mean. If when I say going the only way out is through, if that's a way out, if there is something left at the end, like if we ignore war crimes because of fear of risk of misinformation, then yeah, maybe we won't have anything in the end when we get out of this. Well, but I completely agree with you. I agree that we should fight misinformation. I think that makes it faster for people to realize that they shouldn't, how they should process information and learn how they should process information. I was worried that I was misunderstood, that I was saying, no, let's fan the flames. No, I'm saying we should still fight it. But I think there are enough agents, bad agents in the world that will do this anyway. So I'm just trying to stay hopeful. That's why I have that radical idea.
No, I think it's important to stay hopeful. I tend to be sometimes a pessimistic person, but I do think it's really important to stay hopeful, because there are, lots of people who deeply care. There are people who are working as journalists, as fact checkers, as academics, as teachers, as people, even talking to your neighbor. There are so many people who do care about this still, who do fight misinformation even on their day-to-day. And I think it's something that does give you hope, is that we haven't given up. We haven't succumbed all to just like, oh, we'll just see what happens. And there's like, I'll talk to students occasionally, and there's so many wonderful students out there who have grown up now in this era, where they've had to deal with like the idea of misinformation as being a sort of constant proliferation in their lives and news and media. And it's I think at least extremely uplifting to see that they care deeply about that as an issue. If you talk to people who are like high school students right during the pandemic and now and like undergrad and they're at this crux where they've grown up with this idea and this problem their whole life, and they know it's a problem. I think that's what kind of still gives me hope is that the next generation after us, they care. And they want it solved as well. So I think it's not all lost.
That's wonderful. It's good to hear.
Paulina, this was absolutely an incredible time, and thank you so much for sharing your opinion, your expertise, your wisdom with us. I want to encourage absolutely everyone to check out Bellingcat and the work they do along with Colina and her colleagues. I think it's essential in a time when we're trying to educate and correct misinformation out there. So Colina, again, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is a fun chat. I really enjoyed it.
And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to another episode of The Gateway, brought to you by NIU's College of Business. Please make sure to subscribe to The Gateway. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever podcasts are found. And if you are so inclined, please feel free to give us those 5-star ratings, which help allow us to continue to bring wonderful guests to The Gateway. Thank you all for listening, and remember to love always the promise of tomorrow today.